You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right. Since we're at the end of the book of Acts, it probably makes sense that we begin by looking at the beginning of Acts. And I think the central question we want to start with is, how did Christianity go from being this Jewish religion to then including the rest of the world? Today, the majority of Christians live outside of Israel, and they also live outside of the West. And so, how did this happen? Well, at the very beginning of the book of Acts, Jesus, before he went back to the Father, said in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, to his disciples, "You will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses, telling people about me everywhere, in Jerusalem, throughout Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth." So we read about in Acts chapter 2 through 4 that it began right there in Jerusalem, where Jesus had been crucified, where he had been raised from the dead. And then it radiated out to Judea, which is the larger part surrounding Jerusalem. And this was detailed in Acts chapter 5 through 7. And then the good news of Jesus then went out to an area not far away from Jerusalem, but ethnically very different, Samaria, in Acts chapter 8. And so God, at that point, was crossing cultural boundaries, ethnic boundaries. And then in Acts chapter 10, we read of the beginning of God going to the non-Jewish world. And so this really is the outline of the book of Acts and where most of the book of Acts lies, which is where God is going out to the entire world. And when you think about it, what's happening today is still an extension of what was happening in the book of Acts, what started there in Acts chapter 10. And so when we look out broadly into this world here, the known world, Paul throughout Acts went on these different journeys, sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, and churches were planted in these different areas throughout the world. So before we actually jump into our narrative, it's good for us to sort of go back to where we left off. We left off in Acts chapter 23, and we're not going to read all of Acts chapter 24 through 26, but let me summarize it. You know, Paul was, remember, captured in Jerusalem, and because there was a plot for his life, they actually took him to Caesarea. Roman soldiers took him out of the city under guard to Caesarea. And there, he actually met the governor of Judea at the time, Felix, who the Romans had installed as the ruling person over this area, this region. And so it's interesting when you look at the narrative, if you have time, I'd encourage you to look at it. But when Paul actually comes before Felix, Felix was this guy who was really up to date on current events. And so he knew a lot about what was called the way, which is Christianity. And his wife actually was Jewish. And so when Felix brought Paul into his court to speak, Paul used that as an opportunity to share the good news of Jesus Christ. And what Felix did was he kept Paul there for some time, hoping that Paul would actually bribe him with some money. But that lasted for 2 years, and eventually Felix was succeeded by this guy named Festus. And when he was before Festus, Festus asked Paul, he said, "So why are you here?" And he says, "I've been wrongfully imprisoned. I'm being accused of things that didn't actually happen." And so what he does is he appeals to Caesar. And an appeal to Caesar was a right of any Roman citizen to have a fair trial in Rome. And so Festus said, "If you appeal to Caesar you will go." And so this begins this long journey to Rome. But before he actually goes to Rome, King Agrippa, who was one of the last Herodian kings, came to Caesarea to visit with Festus. And he was interested to hear what Paul had to say because He had heard about all of the things that were happening in Jerusalem and throughout the world. And so, of course, when he speaks in front of Agrippa, what does Paul do? He shares the good news of Jesus Christ. And the reason why he did this was because Jesus made it very clear when he confronted him as he was actually going to Damascus to go and persecute believers. Jesus said that you will be my witness and you're going to come before kings and governors and you're going to testify about me. And so Paul was fulfilling his calling. So what happens from there is that he gets transferred from Caesarea and he takes a 2,200-mile epic sea voyage across the Mediterranean Sea that takes him all the way up into Rome. And when you look at these two chapters, there's so much detail here. And you wonder, like, why spend two whole chapters talking about a sea voyage? You could probably summarize it in a few sentences or maybe even a paragraph. But this is actually the third we passage in the book of Acts. If you've been with us, you know that there is, in the narrative, a switch sometimes where the author, Luke, goes from the third person to the first person plural. We went here and we sailed over here and then we went and strengthened these believers. And it's amazing because the level of detail in the account skyrockets at that point. And so it makes sense that the last two chapters are detailing this sea voyage that Luke was on. And it's interesting too because Luke was a physician, he was a doctor. He was not a sailor, and yet experienced yachtsmen like James Smith, who actually sailed the Mediterranean in the 1900s, stated that Luke's details are stunningly accurate. So what we have here, again, in the narrative, is not something that was probably written decades or even 100 years later by one of Paul's disciples. Instead, what we have here is an authentic account of somebody who was actually there. So let's begin. Acts chapter 27. We have a lot of reading to do, but really what we're doing is we're just looking at the story and allowing God to tell us what this is all about. When the time came, we set sail for Italy. Paul and several other prisoners were placed in the custody of a Roman officer named Julius, a captain of the imperial regiment. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was also with us. We left on a ship whose home port was Adramidium, on the northwest coast of the province of Asia. It was scheduled to make several stops at ports along the coast of the province. The next day, we docked at Sidon. And so just to kind of help us out, we're going to be looking at this map here. They go northeast from Caesarea to Sidon. Julius was very kind to Paul and let him go ashore to visit with friends so they could provide for his needs. Putting out to the sea from there, we encountered strong headwinds that made it difficult to keep the ship on course. So we sailed between Cyprus and the mainland. Keeping to the open sea, we passed along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, landing at Myra in the province of Lycia. Then the commanding officer found an Egyptian ship from Alexandria that was bound for Italy, and he put us on board. So this ship is not like a small boat, right? It's not like a tiny sailboat. This was a large vessel, a cargo ship. We know this because in verse 37, later on in our narrative, there were 276 people on board this ship. And some estimates of ancient ships based on archaeology and some written material that we have suggest that ships like this were 180 feet long and 45 feet wide. So these are huge. I mean, think about that. You know, on a football field, this is 60 yards. Verse 7 says, we had several days of slow sailing, and after great difficulty, we finally neared Cnidus. So this was probably such rough winds, such hard headwind, that they were going maybe 2 or 3 miles per hour. So this was a long stretch of the ship or of the journey. But the wind was against us, so we sailed across the Crete and along the sheltered coast of the island past the Cape of Salmone. We struggled along the coast with great difficulty and finally arrived at Fair Havens near the town of Lasea. We had lost a lot of time. The weather was becoming dangerous for the sea travel because it was the Day of Atonement. Now, why is he bringing up the Day of Atonement, or what we refer to today as Yom Kippur, one of the holiest days in the Jewish calendar? The reason he's bringing this up is because it falls sometime after October. And it's known that sailing in the Mediterranean in the fall is treacherous, that there are storms that oftentimes shipwreck different vessels that are trying to sail out there. Paul spoke to the ship's officers about it. Many said, "I believe there's trouble ahead if we go on. Shipwreck, loss of cargo, and danger to our lives as well." But the officer in charge of the prisoners listened more to the ship's captain and the owner than to Paul. And since Fair Havens was an exposed harbor, a poor place to spend the winter, most of the crew wanted to go on to Phoenix and spend the winter there. And so Paul got outvoted 3-1. They're like, "No, we're proceeding." When a light wind began blowing from the south, the sailors thought they could make it, and so they pulled up the anchor and sailed close to the shore of Crete. But the weather changed abruptly, and a wind of typhoon strength called the Northeaster burst the island and blew us out to sea. The sailors couldn't turn the ship into the wind, and so they gave up and let it run before the gale. We sailed along the sheltered side of a small island named Cauda, where with great difficulty we hoisted aboard the lifeboat being towed behind us. Then the sailors bound ropes around the hull of the ship to strengthen it. So at this point, the ship is coming apart because this incredible storm is tearing it apart. And you know, these ancient ships have planks that run the length of the ship. And so what they were doing is they were putting ropes below the ship to brace it for this storm. This is actually a known practice in the ancient world called frapping. And they would have to do this because when these strong winds would come, it would just shatter these ships. And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, your old 2001 Honda Civic that you're trying to hold together, you know, with duct tape or with, you know, zip ties. I like this one. It's tough. I like the fact that the red tape matches the paint. And so they were afraid of being driven across the sandbars of Syrtis off the African coast. And so they lowered the sea anchor to slow the ship and were driven before the wind. So they're trying to throw the brakes on this ship as it's about to run aground. The next day, as gale force winds continued to batter the ship, the crew began throwing cargo overboard. The following day, they even took some of the ship's gear and threw that overboard. And so you can just imagine how desperate this situation is. You know, the owner of the ship is right there. He's probably the one like, "Throw all of this stuff overboard." Because he knew that his and all of their lives were at stake here. The terrible storm raged for many days, blotting out the sun and the stars until all hope was gone. Back then, they didn't have modern navigation tools like we do, like GPS. And so they had to navigate by the sun or the stars at night. And when they couldn't see it because of the storm and the clouds and the overcast skies, they finally were at a place where they were helpless. No one had eaten for a long time. And finally, Paul called the crew together and said, "Men, you should have listened to me in the first place and not left Crete. You would have avoided all this damage and loss." So Paul's like, "What did I tell you? Should have listened to me, right?" But he says, "Take courage. None of you will lose your lives, even though this ship is going down." So how does Paul know this? How is it possible for him to have such confidence that they are going to survive this journey? He tells us in verse 23 and 24, he says, "For last night an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me And he said, Paul, do not be afraid, for you will stand trial before Caesar. What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. So take courage, for I believe God. It will be just as he said, but we will be shipwrecked on an island. You know, I think about this, and what Paul is expressing here is incredible confidence. And the reason why he can do that is not because he's an amazing seaman. Instead, he has confidence because he knows that God has promised that he's going to make this journey. And so when God makes a promise in Scripture, or when he tells that to us in an audible voice, like what happened here with Paul, we can be confident. We can trust that what he says is going to happen. We can bank on it as if it already happened. Look at all the incredible promises and the confidence that people have shown throughout the ages in God. Joshua 21, verse 45 says, not a single one of all the promises the Lord had given to the family of Israel was left unfulfilled. Everything he had spoken came true. Or what about Psalm 89? Your faithfulness is as enduring as the heavens. The Lord said, I've made a covenant with David, my chosen servant. I've sworn this oath to him. I will establish your descendants as kings forever, and they will sit on your throne from now until eternity. He told this to David. And then he says, even if they do not obey my decrees and fail to keep my commands, I will never stop loving them, nor fail to keep my promise to them. I will not break my promise. I will not take back a single word that I've said. I've spoken an oath to David, and in my holiness, I cannot lie. When God gives you a promise and you trust him, you place your faith in him, you can be confident that that's going to happen, that God is going to come through. It's in his very nature to come through. He cannot lie. Well, about midnight on the 14th night of the storm, as they were being driven across the Sea of Adria, the soldiers sensed land was near. They dropped a weighted line and found that the water was 120 feet deep. But a little later, they measured again and found that it was only 90 feet deep. They probably couldn't see much further ahead of them. And so they needed to take what are called soundings, which is what they're doing here, where they put a heavy weight on a rope, and when it hits the ground, they can tell how fast they're coming up on land. At this rate, they were afraid they would soon be driven against the rocks across the shore, and so they threw out four anchors from the back of the ship and prayed for daylight. Then the sailors tried to abandon the ship. They lowered the lifeboat as though they were going to put out anchor. But Paul said to the commanding officer and the soldiers, you will die unless these sailors stay aboard. And so the soldiers cut the ropes to the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just as day was dawning, Paul urged everyone to eat. You have been so worried that you haven't touched food for 2 weeks, he said. Please eat something now for your own good, for not a hair of your heads will perish. Then he took some bread and then gave thanks to God before them all. You know, he didn't go down below deck. He did this right in front of everybody and broke off a piece and ate it. And then everyone was encouraged and began to eat, all 276 of us who were on board. After eating, the crew lightened the ship further by throwing the cargo of wheat overboard. And so it'd be good for us to kind of stop here for a moment and kind of take inventory of what we've read. The first thing is that God stood with Paul in the storm. You know, we read about this in Acts chapter 23, the last time we were all together, that when Paul was discouraged and afraid, what happened? It said that the Lord came and stood near Paul. And then again, it says that in the midst of this storm, God stood near Paul. And so, you know, if you are someone who doesn't believe that God exists, you're not sure that he's real, what happens when the storm comes? Oftentimes, you have to endure it alone. And so the best advice that people can give to you is, you know what? Why don't you hang in there and hopefully you'll get lucky. But as a follower of Jesus, we have far more confidence in that. We know that God actually cares for us and that he'll stand by us even when we're in the middle of suffering. The second thing is that storms have a way of revealing character. You know, some of the sailors were trying to escape. Others were just there hoping not to die. And Paul was there placing his faith in God. You know, sometimes when people act out, when they're suffering, their friends or their family will be like, you know, please don't mind him because he's been going through a really hard time. And the implication is that because he's suffering, what he's doing is an anomaly. It's not who he really is. But the reality is crises bring out both the best and worst of who we are. And God allows crises and suffering and trial to come into our lives to expose that, to reveal that to us so we can see it clearly. You know, even the worst storms cannot hinder God's purposes. When we look at the difficulties that Paul endured, even throughout all of that, God knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, God is sovereign. And what that means is that he has authority. He has rule over all events in human history. And that's important for us to remember, especially as we are suffering, that God has not lost control. You know, I want to be clear about this. You know, God does not cause your suffering. He is not causing tragedy to come into your life. That's not how he operates. He doesn't play both sides of the chessboard, so to speak. Instead, what's happening is that circumstances, living in a fallen world, are befalling us, and God can see 40 moves ahead. That's exactly what's happening. And so when we are fearful, when we are anxious, what that is that we are fearing what's uncertain. And you know what happens when you have anxiety or worry? It's you're expending all of this energy creating scenarios or hypotheticals of things that may happen. And the reason you do that is because if they do happen, you feel like, you know what, I'm informed. At least I know that this is going to happen. And yet the reality is we can never really tell how things are going to turn out. How many times have we spent energy, emotional energy, trying to figure out what could happen only for that thing never to happen at all? We just wasted our time. But instead, God knows the end from the beginning. He knows the future in the same way that we can see the past with clarity. And so when we trust in God, we don't have to be afraid. We know that he is in control of all the events that are happening in history. And finally, storms give us opportunity to serve others and share Christ. You know, Paul was the most valuable person on that ship. Prior to this, he had gone on 3 different sailing journeys. He had been shipwrecked several times. He had traveled 3,500 miles on sea. And so he was valuable, but it wasn't for any of those things. The reason why Paul was valuable was because he was hearing the voice of God. God was speaking to him. And so Paul had the ability to look at the situation that he was in, and instead of worrying about himself, was able to worry about others and serve them. And so you see this a lot, where, especially in other countries where there are, you know, wars, famine, political crises that are happening, that are tearing apart a country, you have people who are living in the midst of that crisis, sharing in the same suffering as the people that they are serving. And it leads oftentimes to questions, why are you doing this for me? And it gives them an opportunity to be able to share, it's because I know Jesus and he's changed my life. When morning dawned, they didn't recognize the coastline, but they saw a bay with a beach and wondered if they could get to shore by running the ship aground. So they cut off the anchors. Then they lowered the rudders, raised the foresail, and headed towards shore. But they hit a shoal and ran the ship aground too soon. The bow of the ship struck fast while the stern was repeatedly smashed by the force of the waves, and it began to break apart. So as they're getting toward land, the bow of the ship, the front, hits this sandbar, and it gets stuck. And so the rear end of the ship is exposed, and it's just getting pounded from behind over and over again by the waves. Well, the soldiers wanted to kill the prisoners to make sure they didn't swim ashore or swim ashore and escape. If you remember Acts chapter 16, if you were with us, the reason why these soldiers had this instinct was because under Roman rule, if you were a soldier and you had prisoners under your watch and they escaped, it was their life for yours. And so they were going to kill all of these prisoners. But the commanding officer wanted to spare Paul, so he didn't let them carry out their plan. Then he ordered all who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land. The others held onto planks and debris from the broken ship, so everyone escaped safely to shore. Acts 28. Once they were safe on shore, we learned that we were on the island of Malta. So they had made it pretty far. And the people of the island were very kind to us. It was cold and rainy, and so they built a fire on the shore to welcome us. As Paul gathered an armful of sticks and was laying them on the fire, a poisonous snake, driven out by the heat, bit him on the hand. I hate when that happens. I mean, it's official. Paul is having a bad day, right? I mean, after all of this, he gets bitten by a venomous snake. And so, you know, what is it going to take for somebody like Paul to quit or just crash out, right? I mean, he's just like, what is his threshold? When is he finally going to be like, I'm done with this, after all that we have read throughout the book of Acts? And, you know, it makes you wonder, as you evaluate your own life, you know, what is your threshold? What's the thing that's going to eventually stop you from serving and following God? You know, as long as I'm not having a bad day. You know, I got a headache. I didn't drink enough water. I didn't bring my Awala to work. And, you know, I didn't have any seltzers or poppies. So, you know, I think my gut's a little bit of out of order. So I'm just not sure. You know, as long as I have nothing else to do, right? It's as long as it's convenient for me. As long as I get my 8 hours of sleep. But if anything interferes with that, no, I'm not going to do that because I need to optimize my life. As long as I get recognition. As long as people notice and commend me for trying to follow God. But, you know, as soon as that disappears, I'm not sure. As long as I don't have to put in too much effort. As long as this doesn't cause me to feel stressed out. As long as I can be certain that I don't look like a failure. Or as long as my friends follow God with me. You know, what does it take to stop you from serving God in obedience? Whatever that is, God's enemy is going to throw that at you. You can be certain of it. And so, whatever area you look at and can say, you know what, I think that that right there is a vulnerability, that's something that you need to reflect on. There needs to be some evaluation because, you know what, if you cannot secure a failure point, you will fail at that point. Verse 4 says, the people of the island saw it hanging from his hand, and they said to each other, a murderer, no doubt. Though he escaped the sea, justice will not permit him to live. If you know Paul's story, there's an irony to this. Because indeed, he was a murderer. When you look at Paul's life before he actually met Jesus, he was complicit in the murder of this man named Stephen, a godly man. And so they were right, not about the polytheism, but the fact that he was guilty, that he deserved to die, that he deserved to be separated from God. But here's the thing, the message that brought transformation to his life, that has transformed my life, that has transformed most of your lives, is a message that teaches that God doesn't give us justice or what is fair, he gives us grace. Justice is what God poured out on Jesus. What we get is forgiveness. You know, Jesus was righteous, and the Bible declares that we are evil. But Jesus gave us righteousness by paying for our evil. He got what he didn't deserve, and we got what we didn't deserve. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, if this just sounds like, you know, a riddle to you, then you don't have a relationship with God. The message of Jesus, the message of the Bible, is that God paid an incredible price to forgive you for your sins. And the only thing you need to do to receive that forgiveness is to place your faith in Jesus. It's as simple as that. Paul shook off the snake into the fire and was unharmed, and the people waited for him to swell up or suddenly drop dead. But when they waited a long enough time and saw that he wasn't harmed, they changed their minds and decided that he was actually a god. It was 3 months after the shipwreck that we set sail on another ship, an Alexandrian ship with Castor and Pollux as its figurehead, two figures from Greek mythology. Our first stop was Syracuse, where we stayed 3 days. From there, we sailed across to Rhegium. A day later, a south wind began blowing, and so the following day, we sailed to the coast of Puteoli. We found some believers who invited us to spend a week with them, and so we came to Rome. So Paul finally makes it there. And when we arrived there, Paul was permitted to have his own private lodging, though he was guarded by a soldier. And so I'm sure that Paul felt a sigh of relief. Not that he ever doubted God, but I'm sure that that was an incredibly stressful situation that he was in, to say the least. And so for the next 2 years, he was stationed here in Rome and in prison. Paul lived in Rome at his own expense, and he welcomed all who visited him, boldly proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ, and no one tried to stop him. So that's our narrative. That's the end of the book of Acts. You know, as we ponder this, it must have been difficult for a guy like Paul to sit in prison for 2 years. If you know anything about the Apostle Paul, this guy was active. He didn't like to sit still. Some of us are like that, right? We like to stay busy. And so God knew that the only way to get this guy, Paul, to actually calm down and write was to actually chain him up in a prison. And there he authored the prison epistles, which billions of Christians over 2 millennia have gathered strength from. Many of us, most of us in this room, have been moved by these letters. And so Paul was able to make a great impact on the world, even though at the time he had no clue what God was doing. So what conclusions can we draw? First, we need to have a willingness to persevere. If you're a new follower of Jesus here, enjoy the excitement. Enjoy that wave of euphoria that comes from knowing God for the very first time and having a relationship with him. That's amazing. And you should cherish that, but it's not always going to last. As you mature in your relationship with God, there are going to be times where you're going to have that again, but then there are going to be other times where you're going to have difficulty, where you're going to struggle, where those things that you thought you were past are going to come back up. And especially when suffering comes, it's going to test your faith. And the question is, are you going to persevere or are you going to quit? And if you have not settled in your mind that you are going to follow God no matter what, and if you have not evaluated those failure points where you could lose your faith, then unfortunately, you're not going to make it. And so we need to persevere during difficult times. Secondly, we need to be able to express confidence in God at all times, not only when times are really good, but also when we are suffering. Think about the Apostle Paul. As he was suffering, as they were shipwrecked, what does he do? He gives thanks to God, right? In front of everybody. And it's possible to do that, to show gratitude even in the most acute suffering. I've seen people do it. To express joy. Also, we need to show flexibility and initiative to serve God in any situation that we're in. If we set limits on how and when we're going to follow God and how we're going to serve Him, the impact we're going to have is going to be blunted. And so we need to be able to say to God, whatever it takes, whatever you want from me, I'm willing to do it. And so let's do a postscript. What happens to Paul? Because this is where the narrative ends. Evidence suggests that Paul was actually acquitted in Rome. For instance, 1 Timothy was written after this first imprisonment in Rome. And Paul, if you've read 1 Timothy, says to Timothy, hey, make sure to bring my tunic and my parchments. If the chronology is right, this would be 6 years after. Like, why would he care about his tunic 6 years later? You know, forget that, right? It's more likely that this was something that happened more recently. Secondly, the book of Titus says that he was working among the churches in Crete. And we know that no churches were planted in Crete in the book of Acts. And so it must have happened probably after this time. And finally, there's good evidence to suggest that Paul actually went back to Rome later on. Church history tells us that he was later executed in Rome when Rome famously burned to the ground when Nero was the emperor. Nero blamed it on the Christians. And so the church fathers tell us that actually Peter and Paul were rounded up from the city, and Paul was actually beheaded for his faith in Jesus Christ. And so Paul died the same way that he lived for Jesus, in total obedience and faithfulness. And so when we look at the book of Acts, it kind of ends on a cliffhanger. And there's a reason for that. Because this mission that Jesus sent us to complete has not been fulfilled yet. It's being fulfilled in our own day, and we get to take part in it. And so we get to be a part of this book. We get to be written into how God is able to use believers of many generations after this book to impact the world. And there you have the book of Acts. Yes, Lord, thank you for the book of Acts and just how it gives us an incredible vision for what we can experience even today in the 21st century, that your Spirit is still active today as it was back then. And we long, Lord, to be just a part of this great movement and this work that you are able to accomplish, not only in the world, but just, you know, throughout history. And thank you, too, for this section of Acts as well. Just struck by how this narrative really highlights your sovereignty over history. And I pray that that can give us comfort and give us assurance and help us to feel less worried as we live our lives, knowing that as storms blow into our lives, that you are right there near us and that you have a plan in place. And I pray, too, for those of us, Lord, who have never placed our faith in you, who don't have a relationship with you, I pray right now in their hearts that they would turn to you and just surrender their hearts to you, that they would ask Jesus for the gift that he purchased on the cross. And we thank you for anyone who did that in your son's name. Amen.